Today in Studio 360, the twee courteous English, keeping calm and carrying on. Tell that to the men and women around Henry VIII.
It's a uniquely English story. Nobody else has this monster king, of whom we are actually perversely proud.
I'll talk with the writer Hilary Mantel about the television and Broadway adaptations of her best-selling novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. Plus, Juliette Binoche has spent her career making art house films that win awards at film festivals. So how exactly did she end up in Godzilla?
Things come to you in a mysterious way, and sometimes you say, yeah, that's what I needed to do.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But first, over the years, our idea of Henry VIII, both as a man and a king, has been shaped by plays and movies and TV shows. But now, the novelist Hilary Mantel has definitively revised that picture. In her novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, she focuses on a less well-known figure around Henry who has always been depicted as a kind of a weasel, Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell was the son of a blacksmith who maneuvered his way to become Henry's right-hand man. The novels have been huge bestsellers, and they both won the Man Booker Prize, which is the big award for English language fiction. In fact, Hilary Mantel is the first woman to win it twice. Now, Wolf Hall has been adapted into both a two-part, five-and-a-half-hour show on Broadway and a Masterpiece Theater miniseries on PBS.
You said in Parliament, in a speech some 6 years ago, that I could not afford a war.
Wars are not affordable things.
When I went into France, I captured the town of Terouanne, which you called...
A doghole, Majesty.
How could you say so?
I've been there.
So have I. At the head of an army. You told me I could not lead my own troops. You told me if I was taken prisoner, the ransom would bankrupt the country. So what do you want? You want a king to huddle indoors like a sick girl?
That would be ideal for fiscal purposes.
That's Damian Lewis as Henry VIII and Mark Rylance as Thomas Cromwell in the TV version of Wolf Hall. And Hilary Mantel is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360 and congratulations.
Thank you.
So when did you decide that Thomas Cromwell was going to be the subject, your next subject, along with the court of Henry VIII?
I've been thinking about Thomas Cromwell for 30 years, almost ever since I began writing. I had it in the frame as a really good subject. And you wait for someone else to do it because it's so obvious. And... As I saw the 500th anniversary of Henry's accession approaching, I thought, well, you know what? Nobody's done that yet. It's time I got to it.
And what when you say it's so obvious, what was so obvious about it to you?
It's the arc of his story, a blacksmith's son to Earl of Essex.
And in the 16th century, didn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Poor boys, if they were clever and lucky, they could get on through the church, and the church gave them status. But Cromwell didn't do that. He picked his own path. He didn't really climb the steps of the existing power structure. He just brought his own ladder and smashed it through the ceiling.
And it's interesting what an appetite there remains in this country, especially, it seems to me, for the Henry VIII story. Did you know that? When you sort of embarked on this ambitious project?
I suppose that you're looking at an archetype here. You know, he's Bluebeard. He's straight out of the fairy tale.
He really is. And,
it makes sense the world over.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's a uniquely English story. Nobody else has this monster king of whom we are actually perversely proud.
Well, and indeed, your books and plays make him less of a monster than he has been made before, I would argue.
I try not to judge my characters, really. I ask my readers to walk a mile in their shoes, which is quite difficult when you're looking at a monarch like Henry, who seems such a distant figure. I try actually to see him through Cromwell's eyes. And he sees him close up, and he sees him flawed, and he sees him frightened, and he sees him cold, and visited by ghosts and subject to bad dreams.
Yeah, and it's easier, I think, for readers, and perhaps one of the reasons for the success of the books, to walk a mile in Thomas Cromwell's shoes, who seems more like us than one expects 16th century hangers-on to Henry VIII to be.
That's right. He's humbly born. He has his way to make in the world. But again, it's an archetypal story, we all understand. It's the story of the boy who leaves home and he can't go back. He's always got to be going forward.
And doesn't, as so often happens in those stories, especially in antique times, he doesn't put on airs. There's a kind of populist, I'm just this brewer's boy.
He was a cultured and very clever man, but he didn't seem ashamed of his origins and he didn't pretend to be what he was not. That makes him almost unique in his time.
Yeah. I remember as a child, and when you were a child as well, the big Henry VIII fiction was A Man for All Seasons, which among other things, made Thomas More, Sir Thomas More, the great hero that at that idealistic moment we were supposed to believe was the great hero of this story. Not so much in your telling.
We've almost deified Thomas More by making him something he would have despised.
Really?
We've made him stand for freedom of conscience and tolerance. Those were not qualities that Thomas More recognized.
As we see, because he was killing heretics like crazy.
He was indeed. And what he stood for was obedience to Rome and conformity in opinion. And if you did not conform to his opinion, he tortured you. And in extremis, burned you at the stake. So this makeover of Thomas More into a 1960s liberal, whilst extremely entertaining, and, yeah, you know, let's not take away from it, it was a very good play, a very good film.
Yes.
It has dominated the imagination of two generations, and it's time to look at that myth again, I think.
Well, I think that's what you have successfully done, is now you have changed the historical reality for people.
Of course, you know, there's a tendency to excuse Thomas More, who was in many ways a great man, as if his persecution of heretics was some kind of weekend hobby. You know, he was a great man, except for this little penchant for torture.
Yeah.
But I won't have this because, you know, it was central to his perception of himself.
Yes.
He was proud of his record as heresy hunter.
Again, as I've said, you depict Cromwell as a guy who is relatable to modern audiences. He has this – his marriage is this respectful-seeming partnership. He thinks people ought to be able to read the Bible in English, which was illegal still. He's this – he pulls himself up by his bootstraps. Did you ever think, I might be putting my 21st century ideas of an idealized Thomas Cromwell onto him?
Here's a person who strikes us as having a more modern mentality than his contemporaries. But I'm always conscious that we have to respect people for what they were in their own time. They weren't rehearsals for us, and they're they're not us in some kind of unevolved form. So modern isn't necessarily a compliment.
Right.
I'm trying to look at him as a man of the 16th century, but I'm trying not to slant him so that, as it were, he curries favor with the 21st century.
Just like like people turn Thomas More into a 60s liberal.
But we're all writing out of our own time.
Sure.
That's inevitable.
Yeah. You have been very involved, centrally involved in the plays, the West End and Broadway adaptations of these books, I guess less so with the television miniseries. Did you want to be? Was that like a demand that, no, I'm not just going to sell rights and let somebody else do it?
With the TV series, what I had to do was minimal, but I was there. You don't want to hang over the project of adaptation, but you want to be in the background to help if you can.
You're in the center of these plays. You're still, like, tweaking lines, I hear.
With the plays, it's different, yes. I've been working with the adapter for a couple of years before we came near the rehearsal room. But I turned up as a kind of walking encyclopedia, as a consultant on Tudor life. And I got drawn into the project. So now, as you say, I've reshaped the scripts for Broadway. I've taken over as writer. We're in preview now, and we're tweaking every afternoon and making our jokes work.
Well, speaking of jokes, one of the big differences between the plays and the books is there's much more comedy in the stage version.
Well, the books are witty. They're droll.
Yeah.
It's you smile. In the theatre, that's not good enough.
Yeah,
you've got to point things.
Yeah.
And you can do that so that a line that lies on the page and makes the reader smile becomes laugh out loud funny when actors are animating it.
So you've got one more Cromwell novel to go to finish your trilogy. Do you think that working on the play is going to affect how you write that book?
The third book's already well underway, and it is influenced in all sorts of ways by the theatre production, but not stylistically. That hasn't changed. What has changed is the insights I get from the actors, from working with them, what they give me consciously in discussion or subconsciously in performance. The two projects are running very happily alongside each other, the book helping the scripts and the scripts helping the book. I think, though, maybe it will change the way I write in the future because I'd love to write for the theatre.
Yeah. And why not? You can not that you can do anything you want, but the options are there in front of you. But are you sick of Thomas Cromwell? Will you be goodbye, good riddance, Thomas Cromwell?
I'm more fascinated by him than ever I was. I still can't add him up, and I'm partway through the third book. And I suspect he will elude me at the last, and as soon as his head's off, he'll get up and put it back on again. He's that sort of man.
Exactly. And I could talk about his relative a century later, Oliver Cromwell, whom I want to read the Hilary Mantel version of, but I guess I probably won't get to.
Well, my husband's under instructions, if I start talking about Oliver Cromwell, to shoot me.
Hilary Mantel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Wolf Hall The Plays are on Broadway right now, and the second episode of the Wolf Hall TV series airs on PBS's Masterpiece Theater this weekend. Hilary Mantel and I talk for about 45 minutes about her obsession with historical accuracy, about her next book, and about the time she considered murdering Margaret Thatcher. You can hear all of it at studio360.org. Here at Studio 360, we get lots and lots of music sent our way. And one of the new records we recently got, Music in Exile by the band Songhoi Blues, is really one of the keepers. The group lives and plays in Mali, in Africa. What's incredible, besides those great hard-rocking Anglo-American-sounding guitar riffs and the sheer energy of the songs, is the fact that in 2012, Islamic extremists took control of northern Mali, where they lived, and banned all music. The Islamists destroyed radio stations and burned instruments, and musicians were threatened with torture and death. The band's lead singer, Umar Tora, fled the Islamist northern part of the country for the south. He says, "We've come to the city of Bamako and we decided to create something to lift ourselves out of the pain. We can't go on being afraid and we have to resist. And our way of resisting is our instruments." The band is called Songhoi Blues. Their record, Music in Exile, is out now, and I highly recommend you check it out. And you can find out more about them and other musicians in Mali in a new documentary called They Will Have to Kill Us First. Coming up, another native French speaker, a world-famous one, explains why, after winning an Academy Award, she hid from Hollywood.
There's a sense of guilt, you know, when you're successful in France. And so I think I was going through my guilt.
Juliette Binoche is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. The drawings of Trenton Doyle Hancock look like they came out of the notebook of an inspired teenager stuck in a very long and boring lecture. They're absolutely jam-packed with these tiny, dense, fantastical pen and ink detail and splashes of intense color.
Very bright, right out of the tube colors like red and bright yellows. The base color of this painting is pink. And in a way, it's the color that ties all of humanity together, because if you, you know, we're pink on the inside. I did a little research.
Most artists are shaped by their childhood obsessions, but Hancock, who's 40, has made a career out of his. His paintings and drawings overflow with freaky characters and complicated storylines. Think Hieronymus Bosch crossed with Andy Warhol, maybe on the cover of a sci-fi paperback. Trenton Doyle Hancock talked to Studio 360's David Krasnow a few years back about how the stuff he read and saw as a kid in the 1970s and 80s fuel his art today.
Even the walls of Trenton Doyle Hancock's exhibit are painted, with big black drops coming down from the ceiling and pooling along the baseboard in little waves. Each has a white letter in it. They spell out F. E-A-R.
There's this actually amazing fairy tale book called The Very Tall Book of Make-Believe. I think my grandmother was an elementary school teacher, and this is one of the books she had on her shelf. And the stories were very strange, like little kids getting pulled under doors and they'd be flattened out. Just creepy enough to maybe not be suitable for kids.
This is a guy who knows how to relate to his inner child.
I was lucky to have grown up in a time when there was this explosion of really weird sci-fi based toys, like Masters of the Universe, Thundercats, all, and it was always good against evil. You know, I'd get a few action figures and set them up and just look at them as sculptural objects. The bad guys were more interesting looking than the good guys. I was like, man, why didn't Skeletor just blow Eternia to hell and start his own place? Like, he had this beautiful blue skin. I was like, wow, he's blue. He-Man, he's just some, like, blonde dude. That's not cool.
Now Hancock has his own mythical universe, where he gets to make all the rules.
The story that I've been working on is about these characters that are trying to find salvation through color.
There are two kinds of characters here. The first Hancock calls mounds.
Mounds, and they're like little, like mountains with fur on them. And they sort of represent the earth and have these big stupid smiles on their faces all the time. Mounds are filled with meat.
The others are vegans.
They were humans that were banished to this lower realm. And all of their humanity was stripped away from them. All the things that make us human, like hair. Vegans don't have any hair, and vegans have lost the ability to see in color. Their eyes have now become bloodshot and huge.
Now, wait a second. These creatures are called vegans. Vegans, like those super vegetarians who don't eat eggs or milk or anything from an animal.
I was in graduate school. My girlfriend at the time was roommates with some vegans. Like anybody else associated with any other ideology, can become dogmatic and a little preachy sometimes. Like, this is kind of weird. I come from Texas. Everything's, you know, our vegetables have meat in them. So there's just domestic conflicts, I would say.
I always thought vegans were highly principled, socially responsible types, liberals. Hancock's vegans are hateful. They hate meat, and they hate color. But let the record state that Trenton Doyle Hancock does not hate actual vegans.
I even did a performance for 6 months as a vegan to test my own limits. That's a tough lifestyle. The first few weeks, I would have dreams of eating pizza with cheese on it, like this recurring nightmare. The vegans in my work became more distinct from, say, veganism in real life, which I actually have no problem with, really.
In this show, some of Hancock's vegans are trying to find redemption.
There was this one vegan named Sesam, which is Moses spelled backwards, and he was chosen to guide veganism back into the light, back into color, and back into humanity.
These good vegans, they like mounds. They eat them. They rip pink meat out of them and stuff themselves with it. The meat helps them see in color. Being good is a complicated, kind of icky business. And it's dangerous.
That's what this show Fear is all about. It's about these new good vegans hiding because they're being hunted down and killed. And darkness is being restored to the underworld. On the surface, my work is, it's like little boy art, you know, it's goblins and good and evil. But I think the heart of the work, at least on that level, is that I don't know what good and evil actually are. And we don't know, and it's up to the viewer as to who they choose to identify with.
Hancock still has this obsessive boy's belief in his own made-up world. But he's also got an eye on another world. The grown-up world, where paintings are bought and sold, and good and evil don't show up on people's skin.
I just use the world that we live in as a jumping-off point to get to the strangeness that happens in my made-up world.
For Studio 360, I'm David Krasnow.
You can see some of Trenton Doyle Hancock's work at studio360.org. And if you're in New York, there is a show of his drawings up right now at the Studio Museum in Harlem. Think of the British and European film dramas you've seen in the last few decades. Juliette Binoche was probably in a lot of them. The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Wuthering Heights, The English Patient, Chocolat, Cachet. She is the go-to actress for roles that are sensual but are supposed to have complexity and gravitas. Her latest film, Clouds of Sils Maria, is a very sly meta-movie where reality blurs with fiction. Binoche plays Maria Enders, a French movie star whose breakthrough role in the 1980s was as a young, ambitious girl, kind of like Juliette Binoche. And now, many years later in the movie, that character, Maria, is asked to appear in the same play, but now as the older woman, kind of like Juliette Binoche in this film.
I played Sigrid when I was 18.
And because you were Sigrid, only you can be Helena now.
And the play tells a simple story. An older woman falls in love with a scheming girl that has her wrapped around her little finger. The girl takes advantage of her, squeezes everything she can out of her, then dumps her.
It's called The Real World. Welcome.
Kristen Stewart plays the assistant. Chloe Grace Moretz plays the young actress. And I spoke with the star, Juliette Binoche, a few months ago. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
I understand that you had the germ of an idea for this film, and you went to Olivier Assayas with it. Is that right?
Yes. I phoned him one day, and I said, you know what? I think you should write about the feminine. We need women on screen. And I thought of those three characters and having three points of view and them exchanging roles, actually. And I
sounds kind of abstract as an idea.
Yes, but at the same time, I felt like because I had worked with him before, you know, in Summer Hours, and he's such a wonderful writer, I thought, you know, Olivier is the person I'd like to do the film with.
Yeah, which is why you call this guy up and say, hey, I have this idea. Write me a movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's an invitation to writing. It's not like, write me this movie. You know, it doesn't happen like that. It has to be a little more subtle.
I understand. You seduced him. Figuratively speaking.
You know, seduction in English is not the same meaning as séduction in French.
I know. I'm using the French version.
Do you know what it is?
It doesn't necessarily mean sexual seduction.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Very good. You speak French?
No. But I can pretend. At one point in the movie, there's a very funny scene where you and your personal assistant, the Kristen Stewart character, are watching this ridiculous, made-up, Hollywood-style outer space movie. I want to play a little bit of that.
Well, I stayed because of you, but I could feel my brain cells dying one by one.
Okay, but you don't find her amazing? I think she's totally fascinating.
It's such a stupid character. Come on.
Because it takes place on a spaceship? I know that if it was set on an assembly line or like a farm or something, you'd love it.
That's true. I have a hard time taking bimbos in astronaut suits, mouthing off some generic pop psychology seriously. Been there, done that.
That was Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart in The Clouds of Sils Maria. Been there, done that. A lot has been made over the years of the fact that you turned down a role in Jurassic Park and turned down a role in Mission Impossible and turned down a role in some Indiana Jones sequel. So this year, shockingly, you show up in Godzilla.
Yes.
Did you change your mind about Hollywood?
Well, first of all, it started with a letter of Gareth Edwards, the director. And I was touched by his words and his demand. And I said to my son, you know, oh, guess what? And
he's got a 20-year-old son.
Yeah, and he loves Godzilla. So in a way, it was from him, but not only. It's because it was fun for me to be in something new.
Uh-huh.
And also it was great prep for Sils Maria.
How so?
Well, because it was just before I shot Sils Maria. And I'm saying, been there, done that.
Oh, I see. You had been there. I see. The fiction and reality just don't stop blurring.
You know, things come to you in a mysterious way. And sometimes you say, that's it. That's what I needed to do.
In order to say that line believably, you had to be in Godzilla.
Exactly.
There's a kind of thread, or at least a motif, in a lot of your early movies. Young women who are quiet and very sexual and often appear without their clothes on. And then there's a role like Damage, where you're both – your body is shown. And you're a very silent, cryptic character as well. That must be tough, because it's one thing to be figuratively, mentally naked, exposing the character inside while you are being naked. I would think that would be especially difficult.
Well, acting is difficult. Actually, when you use as an object in a film, as a woman as an object in a film, that becomes a problem. But when you're a subject going through love or, you know, whatever, you know, you need to go through, then it's another story. It's like paintings without nudity. It wouldn't be, you know, the history of painting. It's part of, you know, what art is and what human being is. We don't come to the earth fully clothed. We're naked. There's something about being bare that is very makes you vulnerable and truthful.
Mm-hmm.
So, but how it's used can be tricky. And that's how, you know, as actors and actresses especially, you've got to be intelligent. You know, it happened even in Blue, Kieslowski, who's, you know, one of the greatest directors. And there was a scene where I was supposed to walk naked in the room. And I said, why do you need me naked? And he didn't really know what to answer. And I say, do you know how many questions I have about nakedness and how difficult it is? It's a weight for me and I don't need it. And after a while, he came back to me and said, we won't do it when it's necessary.
Uh-huh.
For the storytelling, when I feel like, yeah, she's exposed, she's in love. Yes, I go for it because I think it's part of life.
Yeah. You won an Academy Award for The English Patient, where you played a nurse who looks after this horribly burned man at the end of World War II. I want to play a bit of that.
What was all that banging? Were you fighting rats or the entire German army?
Nope. I was repairing the stairs. I found the library. And the books were very useful.
Before you find too many uses for those books, you might read some to me.
I think they're all in Italian, but I'll look, yes. What about your own book?
You have won a zillion awards, best actress at Cannes and Berlin and Venice and the Caesar in France. Was winning an Oscar just another award, or was that a special thing?
Of course it was a special thing, but I didn't believe I was going to get anything. And so when they called me, I was very surprised, and I was ready to give it to Lorraine Bacall. Everybody was expecting she was going to get it, and yet she didn't, you know, she didn't stand up, she didn't come. So I thought, you know, in a few seconds, okay, I'll keep it then.
And then the next day you just went back to work, or did it
No, I was fully happy.
Did it change your career? did you get offered more things?
Well, I was during that period of time, I was offered quite a lot of things. But just, I think probably by a way of protecting myself, I went back to Europe. To
avoid going Hollywood?
No, because there's a sense of guilt, you know, when you're successful in France. And and so I think I was going through my guilt. Huh. I was hiding a little bit.
Huh. You have worked with a lot of great directors like Kieslowski, like Godard, like Anthony Minghella. Given how obviously interested you are in this ineffable relationship between directors and actors and the process of filmmaking, I'm surprised you haven't made a film as a director.
I'm surprised too. Well, of course I've been thinking about it. But at the same time, I have to say that I've been working with so many great directors that really allow me to be part of the direction. And I love staying on set. I think that's really has been a key for me, that instead of going away in the trailer,
really?
Or going in a, you know, in a dressing room, wherever, you stay on set and you see what's going on and how the shot is going to be, you know, decided.
So you've had all the training. You've stuck around the set. You can do it tomorrow.
Yeah, but you have to choose the subject you want to say. You know, that's mainly what it is, because putting a camera, it's not that difficult. It's like, how do you want to tell the story? And you know, that's the real thing.
You have, I discovered, painted for most of your life. Really nice portraits, by the way. Some of these your paintings appeared in a movie you did last year called Words and Pictures. Why do you paint?
Why not?
Well, because you've got lots of stuff to do, or
no?
No,
it's just that as I remember, my mother. We didn't have a lot of money, but there was a moment she earned some money. She wrote some
books. She was an artist, right?
Yeah. She bought 100 books of paintings and sculpting. And so I got passionate about those books. And every weekend I would take one or two and I would copy, because I wanted to enter those paintings. I wanted to enter those sculptures.
Well, I'm eager to see your next films. I'm eager to see more art. Julie Binoche, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Juliette Binoche's new film, The Clouds of Sils Maria, is out in theaters right now. Still ahead this hour, Dwight Yoakam and his band are going to play us a few songs.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Stay with us. Stay with us. Now I've blown the ending. Let me do it again. I'll pick it up. Three pairs of glasses. Three pairs of shades. Three pairs of other things. All there in space. Three pairs of shoes.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. As far as country superstars go, Dwight Yoakam has always been the one that doesn't fit. He's this cool, mischievous, mysterious dude in a field of grinning guys and girls next door. He settled in Los Angeles instead of Nashville. He plays and collaborates with rock and rollers. As an actor, he specializes in skeevy roles, a shady doctor, a psycho, an abusive boyfriend. And by mainstream standards these days, Dwight Yoakam's version of country music is pretty unconventional, exactly because it's pretty traditional.
Now his guitar's Cadillac, hillbilly music, lonely, lonely streets that I call home. Yeah, my guitar's Cadillac.
I spoke with Yoakam in 2013 when he had just released his first album of new songs in 7 years, And like everything else about his career, it was full of surprises. Two of the songs were produced by Beck, and the album's name, Three Pairs, is a reference to John Lennon, who was once famously photographed wearing three pairs of sunglasses.
Not the wire rim ones. This is footage from the documentary, The Material World, Living the Material World, that Scorsese did of Harrison. And they cut to Lennon, and Lennon was in full kind of pop mod revolver period kind of wardrobe with these big wraparound, not the later shot that everybody's familiar with. He's wearing kind of the 70s wire rim glasses. These were these huge kind of movie star frames, and he had three stacked on top of it, and he was looking at various angles to the cameraman going, I see you here, I see you there. I said, there you are, huh, John, three pairs of glasses. And I started just to repeat that line, three pairs of glasses, and got up and I wrote it as I walked across.
Really?
Yeah.
The album seems particularly less straight-ahead country than some of your other albums. For most of these songs, the first few bars you can listen to and you don't think, oh, that doesn't sound like a country song yet. Was that an effort with this project from the beginning?
No, it's just an expression of the music I hear going on in my head and wanted to play. I mean, the first three albums to me were explaining why I was who I was, where I came from. I was born in Appalachia and I moved out of there.
I've been to Pikeville, Kentucky, by the way.
You've been to Pikeville?
I have.
In the coal business?
Not in the coal business. Writing about the Hatfields and the McCoys at the time.
Well, that would be that business there, too. Yeah, the Hatfields and McCoys were a phenomenon of Pike County and Logan County, West Virginia, that crossed the border back and forth. And there's a great reference to that whole subculture there in Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell's great book, and the observations they made were really interesting about that. But being born really begat from the culture of non-agrarian geographic locations where you had to engage in herding, you know, livestock as your means of existence. And it gave forth to feuding cultures, you know, because there was no tolerance for any kind of cross-eyed looks.
Gotcha.
Man can't really steal your field of wheat overnight, but he can sure take a lot of sheep, cattle.
But there's, on this record, there are also, in addition to these sort of rock and roll-y songs, there are some open emotional ballads.
Yeah, I mean, there's a
piano ballad.
I didn't go into this. This is purely, I feel, free of genre boundaries. I don't think musicians think of themselves as limited by categorization.
Right. A lot of good musicians don't.
It's just my version of these songs.
Let's hear one.
Okay. I feel self-conscious myself because my rambling tangents have already left us somewhere discussing too much information about feuding cultures in the southeast part of
Kentucky. It's good. Kentucky. It's good. I like it.
But that has everything to do with Heart Like Mine, actually. And that could be a theme for the Hatfields and McCoys. Boys, I saw you coming. Woo! Lord, I saw you coming up the holler. Anyway, here we go.
Good.
Shows in your eyes.
That was Dwight Yoakam and his band performing A Heart Like Mine from his new album, Three Pairs. God, I love that.
Oh, well, thank you.
And that was one of the songs you did with your man Beck, who also a non-respecter.
My main Beck.
Non-respecter of genre boundaries.
No, he's completely free of being tethered to anything that would be limiting in any way. You know, and the great thing about Beck, you know, he's extremely literate musically, but he is wildly sensitive to not interfering with anything that's intuitive.
How did you come to work with him?
We had bumped into each other over the years at the odd event, and I just reached out, cold called him. And so he came by my office. We sat down for about 4 hours and, you know, talked about L.A. And, you know, when you mentioned that musical direction, L.A. and California had a lot to do with that, obviously, too, because there's always been a great commingling going back even to the 30s and the Dust Bowl collision of culture that happened.
When all those Okies came out to
Southern
California?
Yeah, the Okies, Arkies, Texans. It's blew into California. And I think right. That created a culture that – it certainly beget the hybrid forms of country music
right.
That became the
hype. From the Flying Burrito Brothers
and
the Birds.
Yeah, sure, the Birds originally. Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the first country rock band, that Sweethearts album.
Yep. When you were young, you had an album in 1987 called Hillbilly Deluxe. Let's play a track from that, Read and Write in Route 23.
Have you ever seen them put the kids in the car after work on Friday night? Pull up in a holler about 2 a.m. So the light's still burning bright. Do those mountain folks set up that late to hold those little grandkids in their arms, in their arms? Yet I'm proud to say that I've been blessed, touched by their sweet hillbilly charm.
Now, you were a Southern Californian by the time you recorded that.
What is it? It's when you're removed from the environment
right.
That you write about.
Right.
It's easier
to celebrate something once you're no longer living there, right?
Or to articulate more acutely what you came from. And I realized how fortunate I was to have been born into that culture in rural Appalachia, and the uniqueness of it was much more acute. By the time I'd been in Southern California for a couple of years, working on a loading dock and driving delivery trucks, I had a lot of time to kind of contemplate where I'd come from, what that was all about, you know, the hollers and the hills in the 60s, 50s and 60s. The migration out of there was to get jobs in Detroit. Route 23 literally is a U.S. route. It ran all the way down through the Appalachian chain and into Florida, but all the way to Detroit. The brunt of the joke was, what are the three R's that are taught in Kentucky schools? Reading and writing in Route 23
there
North. So I thought, I'm going to turn that joke on its ear for my mother and my uncles and everybody that suffered greater consequences of that kind of cultural bigotry.
Can we, before we talk a little more, can we hear another new song?
Sure, absolutely. What should we do, guys?
Title song.
Yes, do that. Why not do the title song? Three pairs of shades, three pairs of other things, all there in space. Three pairs of shoeless feet, three mindless thoughts, three pairs of wishes for all that you want. That means where you are.
All I hope to give is nothing less than one or two more. Three pairs of glasses, three pairs of shades, three pairs of other things.
That is Dwight Yoakam and his band performing live the title track of his new album, Three Pairs, here in Studio 360. We're not going to have to wait another 7 years to get another album of new songs, are we?
I hope not, but I don't know. I can't make no promises to a fellow like you sitting in a room like this at a time like this. I don't know what I'll be doing.
And do we get to see you in more movies?
I'm at the mercy of opportunity there. You know, every actor is, and I'd love to do more, and there are some discussions about a lot of different things.
Dark roles? Psycho roles?
Oh, no.
Bad guy roles?
No, only a sexy priest will do at this
really?
Point. Yeah.
I would like to see that.
That sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? Why did I say that? And I did, I was going to say, you know, the title track, you know, the reason it became so evident that it was the title of the album is because it's about the nonsense of joy. You know, joy is what the album was about for me, and I hope for the band and all of us that made it, and I experienced great joy in performing it.
You have been a joyful presence here today.
Well, thank you.
You can listen to another song Dwight Yoakam played here live and see a video of that performance at studio360.org. His newest album, Secondhand Heart, is out next week, and he will be on tour around America all summer. Dwight Yoakam and I talked a while longer, actually a lot longer. I asked him about his crossover success, and he ended up telling me a story about a night at one of his shows involving flying beer bowls, a punk rock kid, and somersaulting security guards. You kind of have to hear it to believe it, and you can at studio360.org. That is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. In the meantime, we are curious about the art and film and theater and music and literature you've been enjoying. So visit us at our Facebook page and tell us what the hot ticket is where you live, or even just in your household. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Tal Malad,
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasha Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the new Broadway musical Fun Home tells the real-life story of cartoonist Alison Bechdel growing up in a mortuary and discovering all kinds of secrets.
Come to the Fun Home. That's the Bechdel funeral home, baby.
I'll talk with the show's composer, Janine Tesori, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.